Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Jean-Baptiste Camille Corot is best known as the great master of landscape painting in the 19th century, who bridged the French neoclassical tradition with the Impressionist movement of the 1870s. Corot's figure paintings, although constituting a much smaller, less well-known portion of his oeuvre, are of equal importance to the history of art. These works are the focus of the exhibition Corot Women, on view at the National Gallery of Art through December 31, 2018. Corot also had a long relationship with photography and photographic media, from its growth in the 1850s until his death in 1875. In this lecture, held on October 20, 2018, David Ogawa explores Corot's distinct and complex engagement with photographic processes as source material, expressive medium, and an integral part of his artistic legacy.
Seeing the exhibition come together on the walls has been a great object lesson for me, too, in the differing clock speeds at which the machinery of the museum world and that of the academic art historians has to work. As Mary reminded me, it's something of a cliche that curators should wait until exhibitions are up and on the walls and that the paintings can be studied closely and together until we write and publish the catalogs. So to be honest, if I had been able to see this show without having written the essay about the nudes, I would have wanted to write about Corot and clothing. I think that many would agree that Corot's astonishing translation of fabric into painting is one of the great revelations of seeing these paintings all together at once. So as Mary mentioned, Corot has always defied easy categorization. The great scholar and former curator of the Louvre, Germaine Bazin, noted in the 1940s that Corot seems to play the 19th century backward. He starts out as a realist, and I show you a 1825-26 study from Italy on the left-hand side, and he ends up as a romantic with his Souvenir of Mortefontaine on the right from 1864. And Corot did emerge onto the Parisian painting scene in the 1830s in the newest and the slipperiest of genres, historical landscape. Historical landscape, which is a genre landscapes populated with mythological or biblical narratives, had been acknowledged as a genre since Claude Lorraine and Nicolas Poussin in the 17th century, but it was only in 1817 that the French Academy established an official Rome Prize for this genre. Corot spent a brief time studying with the first winner of that prize, Achille Etna Michelon, before his untimely death in 1822. So Corot's first major salon submission in 1834 was a large-scale landscape drawn from both the close study of nature and academic convention. In this example, the composition carries the eye across the surface and gently into the deep background. The effect of space is achieved through the modulation of planes of varying color and tonality. The space serves as a setting for a small-scale narrative figure. In the case of this picture, the woman in the foreground is Mary Magdalene. In her state of meditation and isolation in France after the crucifixion. The second picture that I want to show from 1835 depicts Hagar in the wilderness, taken from the Old Testament after she and her son Ishmael were banished. This is an interesting example because it synthesizes trees from the forest of Fontainebleau projected into the Holy Land, in the Old Testament Holy Land. And this is an example of the way that the historic landscape sought to synthesize both tradition and immediacy. Both of these pictures thematize isolation, a state of being invisible, in a sense, which is significant, I think, for understanding Corot's relationship to academic tradition. So even though Corot was participating in the academic genre of historical landscape, his early training with regard to the figure ran counter to the tradition of studio work with the model. As Pierre-Henri Valenciennes wrote in his influential 1801 treatise on historical landscape, the genre required experiential knowledge of place and people. And I quote, "Study nature in the actions of people who don't know they are being seen. Observe it on the docks, in construction sites, in workshops, and you will see the difference between these figures and the model, placed methodically on his table and tired of his position." This suggests that Corot was especially sensitive to the artificiality of studio practice, represented on the right-hand side by an Académie that I just saw at the Delacroix exhibition yesterday in New York City. And In contrast, the model's embodied experience, exemplified by Corot's early study on the left, the girl with the distaff. Now, both artists are painting what they see, but they are doing so with very different ends. For Delacroix, it's study, color, saturation, and unity. Corot instead seems to be concerned with subjectivity. So over the course of his career, Corot repeatedly returned to stories and themes that involve tension around looking. At the risk of, quote, going into overdrive about the male gaze, as one reviewer has recently put it, this tension almost always involved women as the object of the gaze. Corot's 1836 salon painting, which is visible in the gallery upstairs, Diana Surprised at Her Bath, is one such example. In this narrative, the hunter Actaeon stumbles upon the goddess Diana and her nymphs bathing. As punishment for catching sight of her divine nudity, Diana changes him into a stag, and he is hunted down and killed by his own hounds. Traditionally, this was a cautionary tale about the interaction between the human and the divine, but it is also about the dynamics of a gendered gaze. Actaeon is destroyed by a female agency that does not want to be seen. And Corot structured this picture in an interesting and unusual way. Traditionally, forbidden gazes align with the view of the desired body in terms of the space. The picture itself becomes a kind of alibi for Diana's punishment. And as a comparison, I show you a 17th century work by Francesco Albani on the right-hand side, can compare it to Corot's picture on the left. But because in Corot's narrative, the narrative is attenuated. Actaeon is placed deep in the pictorial space off to the left. We almost outside of the framing rectangle. Visually, we have to hunt for him. And the tension over the voyeuristic structure is heightened by the fact that Actaeon seems to be so distant while our viewpoint is much closer. At the same time, the goddess herself is already almost fully draped, which also short circuits some of the erotics evident in paintings like Albani's. Another really interesting salon submission of the 1830s is this picture from 1838 that represents the drunkenness of Silenus. This art also articulates similar gendered voyeuristic tensions in, I think, an even more literal way. Silenus, the oldest and wisest of among Dionysus's retinue, is here depicted as a drunken, incapacitated old man. He is tied up with vines, and he is being mocked and tormented by a gang of topless bacchantes. His bewildered expression suggests both the frivolity of the scene as well as an inability or unwillingness to direct his gaze at any of the bodies prominently on display for him. And I show you a detail here of the foreground. And it's interesting to contrast this with a figure study that Corot executed right around the same time, in the late 1830s, of the model in his studio. Like Silenus, this work seems to thematize in an almost uncomfortable way a tension around painting a woman's body. This picture has a tripartite structure, which is something that I've really come to think about more since seeing these pictures upstairs. On the one hand, we have the face of the model, and then we have the glimpse of the body, and then we have a swath of fabric at the bottom of the composition. Each of these is articulated with its own emphasis. The face is painted with sufficient detail in this case to permit us to venture a guess at an expression of pensiveness, resignation, or even something like anxiety. The model's body is treated very frankly through a painterly process of adjustment of color and tone. The fabric below functions as both a pedestal and an abstract surface, which helps to push the body back from the picture plane, holding it at a visual and psychological distance. I think we can see this also in this picture from the Sterling and Francine Clark Art Institute in Williamstown. This model's expression is serious, engaging, and direct, even if it is indeterminate. It is, in any case, amplified by his representation of her décolletage. The richly painted pink skirt sets up a complex push and pull between the planes of the picture, which enhances the exchange of gazes and engages with the charged process of mutual looking. Now, Corot's friend, cataloger, and biographer Alfred Robeau reported that with regard to anatomy and painting, Corot once said, quote, "In a word, I have to bring to painting a chest the naivete that I would bring to painting a milk can." close quote. Now, of course, the naivete is a ruse. Evoking a milk can as a metaphor for a woman's chest is to acknowledge a multiplicity of meanings. Of course, there are lots of ways to read this, but it's an acknowledgement of multiplicity, that chest can be an object of desire as well as an object of comfort and nourishment. So during Corot's third and final trip to Italy in 1843, he painted this work, which in a similar fashion navigates multiple meanings for the nude body. Marietta was one of his most prized paintings, shown, according to Rabeau, only to those who could truly appreciate it. It navigates both genres of nude study and portrait. The model's name, Marietta, is prominently inscribed in the upper left corner. This inscription grants to the model an active agency within the space of the painting, an agency that is underscored by her glance off to the right, outside of the frame. And in this example, which you can also see upstairs, drawing and painting artwork simultaneously, Corot's line does not describe a contour, but it appears and disappears beneath brushed areas, suggesting form rather than defining it. The active mark-making and generation of the image of the body foregrounds its momentary specificity in time and place, and in the identity of the model. This painting seems to resolve tensions, which I would propose have to do with the identification of the model and the location of the painting's creation in Rome when Corot was there. This transforms the artist-model transaction into something more personal, as if Marietta were an active participant or perhaps even a collaborator in the creation of the painting. The scholars routinely compare the work of Ingres' famous Grand Odalisque to Corot's Marietta. I find myself wanting to contrast it instead. The form of the body in Ingres' painting is molded, reshaped, confined, and frozen. This is a body that belongs entirely to Ingres. The form of Marietta's body obviously belongs to Corot, but he gives Marietta what today we would call a credit line. The body is hers, after all. And Corot put this resolution to work in another remarkable painting of Mary Magdalene of circa 1854, unfortunately not in a condition to travel to this exhibition from the Louvre. Mary Magdalene, of course, is another woman whose self-isolation and penance after Christ's crucifixion imply that the view is a voyeuristic one on a figure who is not meant to be seen. Corot deploys a similar tripartite construction, delicately rendered face, completely absorbed in her reading, a bare chest, and a dense, emphatically painted zone of fabric that emphasizes the surface of the canvas and pushes the body and face slightly back into an atmospheric distance. Now, this painting is also significant because it was a commission from Adalbert Cuvelier, who was a member and a photographer and a member of the Arras Circle, which included Constant Dutilleux, one of Corot's best friends, Charles de Savary, and Alfred Rabeau. The latter two would assemble the documentation and reproductions, photographic reproductions, that would form the basis for the 1905 catalog Raisonné. Cuvelier and the Arras group introduced Corot to the technique of cliché verre, which involved the production of handmade glass plate negatives that could be printed like photographs. The Arras group also introduced Delacroix, d'Aubigny, and several others to the technique, but none embraced it as enthusiastically as Corot, who produced more than 65 handmade glass plate negatives between the early 1850s and the 1870s. And this was the most modern reproductive technology available, and it indicates serious engagement on Corot's part with the new medium of photography. So the plates could be produced in different ways, either by painting with ink onto the surface or scratching through lines on a blackened plate. The Dreamer on the left was made with a combination of both methods. Its moody atmospheric effects were in dialogue with Cuvelier's own landscape photography, which I show you on the right, and in many respects anticipates Corot's late romantic paintings. Photography in the 1850s also brought other new tools to artists, and Corot was certainly aware of these. Some of the earliest figural photographs registered for publication and approved for sale, although not always for display, were intended as figure studies for artists and as substitutes for the live model, which was a significant expense at the time. Like cliché verre, these figure studies represented the newest visual technology. For artists who trained and matured before photography was available, it was a transformative new way of seeing. For the young radical realist Courbet, The photograph could serve as the confirmation of his devotion to painting only the world he could see. The photograph validated visual reality, which of course was central to his artistic project. But by 1857, the photographic nude had also become the site of significant social tension around the representation of women's bodies. The assumption that such photographs would be used only by artists was naive, of course, and soon there was a robust underground trade in what the authorities would come to call obscenité. The police in Paris responded with vigorous enforcement against consumers, photographers, distributors, and the models themselves. On the left is an image from the police register that records these enforcement actions that shows how the police used this confiscated obscene photograph to identify and prosecute this model, Augustine Guy, on five separate occasions between 1857 and 1861. And of course, there's no meaningful difference between the image the police called obscene and the artist's study by Dolivier, authorized and printed only a few years earlier. But photography had come to permit the linkage of identity to moral corruption as never before. So we have no documents regarding Corot's knowledge of or response to the arrests of the models that began in 1857, but in 1858, he executed a remarkable pair of cliché vers representing Mary Magdalene. I think in part a dialogue with the painting he had made for his photographer friend, Cuvelier. This penitent Magdalene seems to have begun as a copy or variant of the painting, but her penance takes over the image, rendering the body practically invisible. It is perhaps the most expressive facial expression Corot ever created, a face that is completely lost in sorrow. There's the large version of it. The other version shows the Magdalene begging for God's mercy, rather like the reports that we have from the court newspapers of the photographic models challenging their repeated prosecutions before the magistrates. And these two images were made on the same plate, and in my own attempt to utilize new technologies to interpret them, I've made a digital reconstruction of what I think the negative might have looked like. We might imagine Corot's mark making here as a response to this new trade in photographic nudes, as well as to the role photography was playing in the connection between modeling and moral turpitude. There is a kind of desperate, anxious, expressionistic quality to these lines, as though the nudity and bodies were something that had to be denied and rejected and pushed away. And looking at this material again for the exhibition catalog has also inspired me to reconsider how other artists of this generation might have been responding to not just to photography, but to the whole network of themes of its use. Jean-Léon Gérôme's 1861 Phryne before the Areopagus depicts the trial of a famous Greek courtesan accused of impiety. When her physical beauty was revealed to the tribunal, she was acquitted. Gérôme commissioned a photographic nude from the famous French photographer Nadar as a study, which significantly has the model covering her face and shielding her identity. His alteration of the proportions of the body is usually taken as a sign of Jerome's retrograde classicism, but I think that the commission itself was less as a source material than it was as a document of Jerome's awareness of how the new medium was transforming images of femininity and identity. The painting's construction borders on caricature. But the range of expressions evident in the tribunal is like a catalog of lechery, anxiety, and hypocrisy. In the middle of the crowd at left, however, there is a beardless older gentleman whose gaze upon the model is serene, unsurprised, perhaps simply admiring. I've given in to the art historical temptation to propose that it might be Jerome's stand-in for Corot, whom I show here in a portrait by Pierre Petit from the early 1860s. As Mary discusses in her catalog essay, Corot's respect for and kindness to his models was legendary at this time. Unfortunately, Corot's own collection of photographs is untraceable. All we know is that they were sold as a single lot on the third and final day of the sale, when, of course, all the really good stuff had already been bought. It's certain that he owned or knew this photograph by Louis-Camille d'Olivier, however, and that he used it as a basis for this major painting, the whereabouts of which are unfortunately also unknown. D'Olivier's painting photograph was made in 1854-55, and by the time Corot finished the Secret d'Amour here on the left, the trade in and enforcement against licentious nudes was peaking. A young man from the porcelain shop just a few doors from Corot's studio was arrested for posing for obscenities in 1864, and in the same year, Alexis Otoz, who was one of Corot's art supply dealers, was arrested for selling obscene photographs from his art supply shop. So the Secret d'Amour is like a response to the nude photograph. In addition to transporting the figure from a studio to a landscape, Corot added swaths of drapery, which envelop the figure and effectively undo the blatant nudity of the photograph. He also added the puto whispering into the figure's ear, which gives the painting a mysterious narrative. The painting turns away from the explicit display of the body, and in doing so, recovers something like modesty for the woman who appears in it. The flat, hard light of the photograph is replaced with what Rabeau called, quote, an exceptional quality of painting, like enamel, an effect that Corot could only have achieved by working with a live model after deriving the pose from the photograph. It is really regrettable that we don't know anything about Corot's own photograph collection, because there are multiple examples of resonance between his work and contemporary photography. None as visually certain as that of the Secret d'Amour, but many of the later figural works reflect what could be Corot's processing of what posing for the camera was and how the resulting images in this new technology could reshape painterly vision. Painters like Corot and his friend, the photographer Julien Valude-Villeneuve, certainly had Renaissance models in their visual memories, but they both also had the experience of crafting an image with another living being across the space of a studio, whether it's a painting or a photography studio. I think that we're only beginning to understand the complexity of the dialogue between these two media in the 19th century. So with Corot's 1861 painting, Le Repose, one of the stars, of course, of the exhibition, and shown in the same year as Jérôme's Frini, this can be understood as a kind of summing up, I think, of Corot's concerns with issues around the identity of the model, contemporary photography, and the tradition of the reclining nude. As scholars have noted, contemporary critical response to the work anticipated the derisive tone that would soon be directed at avant-garde realists like Edouard Manet. Alfred Delvaux wrote, quote, "It's a study, a nude woman on a leopard skin. As a study, it seems to me irreproachable. As a woman, it leaves something to be desired with regard to cleanliness. In the brown hues of certain parts of this lovely body, one detects a scaly skin that could only be highly unpleasant to the eye. This is all the more surprising because in Monsieur Corot's landscapes, there is always ample water for bathing." Close quote. Because Corot reworked this painting after the Salon, and luckily we have the drawing by Charles de Savary that shows the original composition, which was more starkly divided between the landscape and the revelers in the background and the reclining nude in the foreground. We can see these changes here with the foliage. With the addition of more foliage and by de-emphasizing the bacchanal in the background, Corot did succeed in unifying the composition more. Other changes included modification to the figure's left knee, which is less prominent, and which also lessens the reference to the knee of the figure in Ingres' Grand Odalisque. The difference in the faces of the figures, I think, is the most significant change. And I hope that's clear enough. I apologize for the fuzzy digital image on the left, even accounting for the translation of the original painting into a drawing, and in full disclosure, the translation of a drawing into a digital image that I shot myself in the Louvre, where the drawing is kept, it seems plausible that Corot changed the facial features of the figure when he reworked the painting after the Salon. At the very least, we can see significant alterations to the headdress, which no longer clings to the back of the figure's neck. In the final version, the negative space is opened up substantially enough to reveal the very distant horizon between the dark ribbon and the figure's head. The form and color even continue on the right side of the figure's face. As I propose in the catalog essay, the face of the figure in the original version seems to resemble that of the Louvre gypsy with a tambourine with its slightly elongated oval shape. I'll show you details here. In the reworked version, The face of the figure resembles that in another of Corot's gypsy paintings, the gypsy with a Basque tambourine. And on the other hand, in one sense, this signals to us what we already know, that Corot had certain facial types that reappear over and over in his paintings. But in the case of the reworked version, there's also a strong resemblance to a model who posed for the photographer Eugene Durieux, who had produced this photograph working with Eugene Delacroix in the early 1850s to produce an important group of figural study photographs. We know that Corot also shared the names of models with Eugene Delacroix in 1859, but we do not know whether Corot owned any prints of these photographs. And what also appeared to be the same model who posed for Corot's friend, the photographer Valued Villeneuve, in several figural photographs that were published in the early 1850s. Of course, the identity of this particular model is of great interest, but would require a great deal more research. In the meantime, what are we to make of the apparent changes to the model's face from one distinct set of features to the other? In the case of repose, it seems plausible that reworking the painting required the employment of a different model, and that the different faces reflect Corot's concern with reassigning the identity of the figure to the second one who posed for him. In this sense, it could signal an abiding aspect of his painting practice since he painted Marietta, that every painting, like every photograph, was at least to some extent a portrait. And as a coda, I would like to just add a few thoughts about my own work as an art historian, trained initially in the pre-digital age. On the one hand, I am cautious about what I've begun to think of as facial recognition art history, because that can easily signal a frightening parallel between what we as art historians do and what the police in Paris were doing with photography in the 1850s, identification, classification, booking suspects, and so on. But at the same time, when I started working on Corot those many years ago at Brown with Mary, the gulf between our reference photographs and the painting themselves looked like this. A page from the 1965 reprint of Robeau's 1905 catalog in grainy halftone, plus some schematic information that required intervening files and notes to be relevant even in the 1990s. Working on this catalog has brought me back to the original documents that Robeau collected, which are part of the collection of the Bibliothèque Nationale in France, but which have been housed in the documentation section of the Department of Paintings at the Louvre. So the first time I saw these in 1993, they might as well have been like original paintings. Giant folios with manuscript notes, drawings after the paintings, contemporary photographic reproductions, which Corot himself likely saw and approved of, and even direct tracings from the paintings themselves. That's what we have down here. This is a direct tracing from the painting. It's full scale. So what we have, I include this amateurish image that I took with my own iPad. You can see the shadow. You see the shadow of my hand, my iPad there, intentionally to suggest that when it comes to the visual materials that form the material history of image making, photography itself is always already implicated in how we construct our interpretations. And I'd like to close with one of the great discoveries from the research that Heather McPherson did for her essay in the catalog, the drawing that Alfred Robeau made in the studio at the very time that Corot was painting the monumental Agostina. It shows us the model posing with the water jug that she originally held, but which has been painted out of that painting. It shows us the space of the studio, where the light was coming from, and what was behind her. It is a drawing, but we would like to see and understand it as if it were a snapshot. Digital imaging promises to bring objects like painting, drawing, and rich manuscript documents closer together than we could have imagined even 20 years ago. So I'd like to draw a parallel with the dawn of the photographic age, when Delacroix, Courbet, and Corot were all marveling over photographs in the 1850s. It seems like for us with digital art history, it's still only about 1865. Thank you. I would, sure, gladly, sure.
You can have some water first.
Thank you. Yes?
Why do you think Coro turned the so many female figures into religious figures? The Magdalenes and Marys and...
The Magdalenes I tend to associate with that constellation of themes that are about a kind of complex spectatorship. Coro did do multiple versions of the Diana story. The other great one, which I cut from this lecture in case I went overtime, were the many versions that he did of Eurydice and Orpheus. Of course, from classical antiquity, Eurydice, the beloved of Orpheus, who is taken to the underworld. Orpheus has to go and rescue her, but as the story goes, as he's leading her from the underworld, he's not supposed to turn and look at her again. And we know Coro did three versions of Eurydice as a sitting figure, and at least two large-scale paintings of Orpheus and Eurydice in the underworld. So Mary Magdalene, in particular, is a theme that he did not only in those cliché vers, but the Cuvelier painting. There are a couple of other single-figure Magdalenes, one of which surfaced a couple of years ago, that shows that's the Magdalene Penitent. And then there's yet another, which I've never seen in any form except in grainy halftone reproductions, that's with the Magdalene practically drowning in her own hair. So all of those figures, even though they cross sort of religious and historical lines, I think have to do with women who were not to be seen. So a very specific kind of voyeurism.
Mm-hmm. I don't know much about Coro, you know much more than I do, and I was just curious with this exhibit that so many of the portraits are of women. I was curious if he did many portraits of men, and if he didn't, why?
Why, that's the, Mary and I were talking about this exhibition a couple of years ago. I was trying to lobby to include some of the men. Coro did very few. There are a handful of pictures of monks wearing elaborate robes, mostly Capuchin monks. There are a few pictures of men in armor, which I think thematically also could be woven into some of my ideas about gender, which stuff I haven't gotten to work on yet. There are a few, but they're... did not receive the same kind of sustained attention. No one's really sure why. In terms of biography, Coro was a bachelor. He remained unmarried throughout his life, and as with many artists in the period, cast himself as being, in effect, married to his work. And so that may be why he chose to pursue images of women so frequently.
David, thank you. That was wonderful and marvelous. The argument you're proposing here, which I think is absolutely right, is that there is a specificity, a recognizability to the model in Coro that has something to do with the emergence of photographic representations of models, and I love the kind of forensic police gaze that accrues around those practices. Another argument would sound a little bit more like what Carol Armstrong has proposed happens in Manet's relationship with the model, which is that what he does is to make paintings about the practice of modeling itself, about the endless repetitions, and thereby kind of opening up the studio to the audience, right, which is such an impetus of Coro's as well, right, in those studio allegories. Let me open the studio for the viewer. So I'm wondering whether those two arguments are, how they sit together in your account. Are they the same? Are they slightly different? Where does that Carol Armstrong reading of the exposure of studio practice as one of the great modernist tenets of representation fit next to what you're proposing to us here today?
I think that they are certainly not incompatible. It's interesting that does intersect with the what we were talking about earlier, this limited knowledge that we have about the intended audiences for Kuro's figural paintings. There's some indication that there was a sort of standing demand for them on the part of dealers and collectors. And they bypassed the circuits traditionally of the salon and weren't widely known, not so much because they were kept secret, but just because they were constituted a different kind of picture in the, within the trade. And I think that in part the circles, right, were pretty tight, and so there's a good likelihood that it seems to me, and this again, I would need to do some more research with the primary documents, but I think that we know that many of Kuro's figural paintings were promised to dealers who may have had particular clients in mind, and so they might not have exactly been commissions, but they would have been sort of made for insiders, and that the recognizability of models could be another factor that actually helps us to think about Kuro as being more closer to the practice of Manet than is traditionally assumed. I think, of course, Susan Waller has also written about similar issues with regard to the way that part of modernist practice was to open up the practice of modeling to intimates, right, family members, and in effect, which is in effect another erosion of the traditional boundary between the portrait and the model. So I'd see those as completely compatible.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I just wonder if the police had any problem with women modeling nude for painters, or was it only when they were photographed, or did they not know about?
Well, the police material that I've been worked on is specific. It's almost entirely specific to photography, but it is specific to representations. So the police weren't monitoring what was actually happening in the studios themselves. They were worried about issues that had to do with publication and distribution, because it is a complicated history of censorship laws, and in France in this period, any publication had to be registered with something called the dépôt légal, which was, in effect, a kind of censorship, but it was also a guarantee that a copy would be deposited with the National Library. That goes all the way back to the 17th century, actually. So what the police were really enforcing was were publication laws, and these get kind of grafted onto laws about moral corruption, and that evolved pretty dramatically in the first half of the 19th century. Some of the other research, there's a book that's actually recently translated into English by Marcella Jakob that is a legal history of the question of outrage against public morals, that book is really about, for instance, the creation of public space in France after the revolution, the idea that you might be seen naked, for instance, from the street. This becomes really a complicated legal issue. So the police activity begins to intersect with that stuff in a way that gets very complicated toward the middle of the century. The other thing I would add, actually I was gonna include it also, but in addition to the art supply dealer getting busted for obscenities, in 1867, apparently somebody called the police about Courbet's exhibition and reported that there was an obscenity. And the note in the police ledger says, somebody reported Courbet exhibited something obscene. We went to look at it. It's just an academy. It's just a nude. But by that time, the police had, the history of that register is very interesting because they stopped using the confiscated nudes by the mid-1860s, and it just becomes portrait photographs of the photographers and distributors. So the last photographs in that police album are just portraits of criminals, essentially. And that is, it was in that office that Alphonse Bertillon, the inventor of the mugshot, was trained as a police officer. And so my theory is that he was familiar with that that album and how it had been used in the 1850s and 60s. Because, of course, the police also had their own stash of confiscated obscenities, which eventually were handed over to the National Library in the late 1860s.
Mm-hmm. Ask you, since you've been thinking about these figures for so long, your sense of the relationship of this practice, of the figural practice, to the landscape project of Corot's life. I mean, is there much of a relationship between the two, or are they completely apart?
Oh, I'd leave it to you to ask the hard question. Yeah. I could rattle on about the police stuff all day, but... I think that's a great question, especially with this comparison up on the screen, because, right, one aspect of the tradition of the artists painting the studio, for instance, right, is that inclusion of works in the background, right? So the studio space comes to be defined as much by, right, what's on the wall behind whatever, what's on the walls, as by what's in sort of at the center of the composition. And I think with Agostina, right, we could practically imagine that Corot's studio, which was, legendarily, was just stacked with paintings, you know, from, and by this time, but almost, 40 plus years of painting. And so I think in some of the figures, and this is another, something else that I've been thinking about since seeing this show, is the idea of the backgrounds, and how might we want to try to think about ways that Corot's figures are figures posing in the studio, but what we see in the background is also like a landscape painting rather than a landscape, and that there's a potentially fruitful kind of, that's one dialogue in terms of thinking of that Italian, which, the little buildings in the background, those could easily come from actually an 1820s Corot painting, right? That the famous Il San Bartolomeo with the Colosseum that I showed at the beginning was part of Corot's, was part of his, the way that his training also really differed from academic landscape painting was that Corot never really used linear perspective, right? He didn't learn it as a geometric and mathematical process. He learned painting buildings like this by plane and tonality. And so those constructions really are characteristic, and those emerge really early with his early work. And so I find myself upstairs wanting to see the backgrounds as being Corot landscape paintings, in which case the figures become the sort of container for his thinking through his own landscape practice as opposed to the other way around. So that might be one way to establish a connection. But I think, and it also, tracing it through the, as you pointed out, this is the largest of single figure in Corot's entire corpus. And so, and it's almost the same scale as the history painting of Diana. And so maybe that is it's a trajectory that he was imagining for himself, is in a sense tackling the figure and letting the landscape get smaller. Mm-hmm.
David, if I could just add on to that. I know you just saw the Delacroix show, and of course Delacroix is very model-driven. And I wonder if you think they're kind of parallels in Corot and Delacroix.
That is something that I'm looking forward to studying more. I don't know enough about Delacroix really to answer that in an intelligent way, I'm afraid, because the points of contact that I know have always been from Corot, but as you point out, Delacroix was very model-driven too. His sense of psychological presence of the model and the way that he maintains that, even in his studies, which while they're more academic, have that vivid, momentary, experiential quality to them too, and I think that, that's a really interesting question. I wish that I could say more about it, but.
I think with the way the landscapes seem to be kind of invented, as mm-hmm. he had in his mind, it becomes a backdrop, you know, for a lot of the Moroccan.
So. Oh yeah, that's so. Would you say that? That Corot is sort of turning more to Delacroix, maybe, with these late.
I'm sort of thinking about is mm-hmm. there a sort of classical, you know, because this is a classical landscape. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if it was because he can take a figure and put it in the studio or out of doors, and we've seen him do that.
Mm-hmm.
With the same figures.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, and because I think certainly by this time, you know, Corot, well, it's that. They, Corot and Delacroix certainly knew each other. They would have been paying attention to each other's work. And one of the things that Corot may have been learning from Delacroix was that ramping up color, right, which is evident, especially again with Corot, especially evident in the fabrics and in those kind of multi-layered skeins of paint that glow, they disappear, they reveal, they conceal, and that is almost like the large scale fabric that Delacroix produces, right? For Delacroix it happens across the whole picture plane, but for Corot he's sort of working it in smaller areas.
Mm-hmm. So I would like to understand the landscape behind this painting. Mm-hmm. Is that freshly painted, or is he simply repurposing something that was in his studio and he just had a canvas that he thought would be a good background for his newfound interest?
For this one, I think the painting would have been painted in the studio, and in the landscape in the background would have been it resembles paintings that he would have had.
The landscape in the background is not 30 years old when the painting was rendered.
No.
It's new.
No, it's new. Yes, it would have been painted simultaneously. Sorry, yeah, if that was a little unclear. But at the same, it does reflect a type. These little tightly clustered geometric forms, everything very defined with a really defined light coming on it. That's very much like a little piece of a Corot from the 1820s.
Mm-hmm. With what you just mentioned about type and what we were talking about earlier with Manet's practice, do you think there's a relationship between Corot's practice and photographic practice of the time with the painted backdrops that they used to photograph models in front of? Is that something that Corot is moving towards type in landscape and
Oh, that's also a very interesting question. I think there'd be a couple of different ways to approach that. I don't know of any scholars who have studied the painted photographic backdrops. Historians of photography do use studio props, for instance, to identify which photographs were made in which studios when that information gets lost, but that it's an interesting point about the sort of media history that the photographing of painted surfaces itself is that Corot may have been thinking about that. Corot himself did sit for many photographic portraits. He was a very popular photographic subject. That's a whole other book that could be written about photographs of him and other artists, because of course this period, you know, part of the social practice of the circulation of photography was also the not just the creation of notorious morally corrupt women, but also celebrity, photographic celebrity was happening. And Koro was very much, very popular as a subject.
David, can you, is there one more question?
One last question, yeah.
Given that these backgrounds seem to be sort of interchangeable, you know, depending on what idea he had in mind, I mean, the figures could begin as a separate idea from what he was going to end up putting in the background, whether it be a landscape or something that's less defined. They're almost like scrims in the theater, in a way. Mm-hmm. Is there any evidence of him taking inspiration from the theater, from the opera, or?
Yes, they're actually good. Fronia Wissmann's dissertation from the early 1990s was on Corot and the theater.
I didn't read that.
Yeah. Well, sorry, to get a little esoteric, but yeah. No, but her dissertation was on that, and she did a lot of work on thinking through the visual structures of his landscape paintings and how those resemble theatrical designs in the period, and which of course brings us back to the theme of music and sort of Corot's own aesthetic preferences and experiences that he went to concerts and operas and plays on a regular basis. He always had a sketchbook with him. He was always drawing, doing little figure studies, there are certainly sketches of sets that he saw. And so that could, I think, productively be brought into conversation with the sort of theatricality of his notion of the artist-model exchange, that it's not just that the model was maybe performing for him too, in that sense. Thank you. Please do come and look at the exhibition upstairs. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.